Welcome to The Faithful Forebears, a podcast about faithful Christian men and women throughout history. Episode 2.7, Gudina Tumsa. Here is my church and my congregation. How can I, as a church leader, leave my flock at this moment of trial? Christ died for all, so that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for him who died for them and was raised again. Never, ever will I escape. Gudina Tumsa. Welcome back. We left off on our story of Ethiopia in the early 20th century with the translator and missionary Onesimus Nesib. So today we're going to carry on our story of Ethiopia forward to the 1980s. And after setting the stage of Ethiopia as a whole, we will meet our forebearer for today. So Ethiopia in the late 19th century was attempting to modernize in a world that was rapidly changing. The Emperor Menelik tried to find new ways to bring modern technology and economics into the country. He also founded a new city near his palace that he hoped could be the center of economy and growth for his nation. It was called Addis Ababa, which means new flower. He established it as the capital of the nation, which it still is today. Emperor Menelik also imported eucalyptus trees into the country, which took well to Ethiopia's climate. Their use as firewood and building material proved incredibly useful to this fledgling city. After Emperor Menelik's death in 1913, one of his grandsons, named Lijj Iyasa, succeeded him. But Emperor Lijj Iyasa converted to Islam and attempted to promote his new religion in Ethiopia. This made him very unpopular, and he was soon deposed. In 1916, one of Menelik's daughters was made to be the queen regent, Zaditua. She would reign until her son came of age. Her son would be an incredible part of Ethiopia's modern history. His name was Ras Tafari. When he was crowned, he took the name Haile Selassie, which means Might of the Trinity. Now you might be thinking Ras Tafari sounds a lot like Rastafarianism, the religion of Bob Marley and others centered in Jamaica. And you would be right. Rastafarianism believes that Ras Tafari was the second incarnation of Jesus. Now Ras Tafari himself never publicly promoted this belief and was always a faithful member of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. But he never really publicly denounced it either. But that would come about much later. When Ras Tafari, aka Emperor Haile Selassie, took power, he had spirit and vision. He wanted to continue Emperor Menelik's quest to make Ethiopia a modern nation. He wanted to reform many of its old practices and improve life for the average Ethiopian. He was educated in Europe and also in traditional Ethiopian faith and practices. He hoped to use both of these to make Ethiopia a player on the world stage, but also for it not to lose its heritage and identity. One of Haile Selassie's first actions was to abolish slavery. This was not an easy task, as Ethiopia had a long history of slaveholding. The Ethiopian Orthodox Church had never condemned the practice, and the only restriction it gave was that Christian slave owners could not sell Christian slaves to non-Christian slave owners. So Rastafari officially abolished it in 1918, but would have to do it again in 1923. And sadly, neither of those really took, because he would have to do it again once more in 1942. Haile Selassie's reforms modernized Ethiopia in some ways, most especially in the capital Addis Ababa. He tried to bring modern bureaucratic rule and move away from ancient systems that were hampering development and growth. He created a constitution, though he still kept his office as emperor strong, as he wanted the power to lead this reform. But he suffered a great setback in his project of modernization when Mussolini attacked Ethiopia in 1935. The Italians, with a much more modern army, backed with tanks, airplanes, and chemical weapons, conquered the country, forcing Haile Selassie to flee in 1936. The Italians were brutal in this warfare and committed many terrible war crimes. and they were repressive to Ethiopian Christians of almost all stripes, both Orthodox and Protestant. The Italians then tried to promote Roman Catholicism, something that, remember, had been tried 300 years earlier by the Portuguese. The result was a similarly dismal failure. Like the Portuguese before, this new persecution hardened Ethiopia's in support of their church and identity. And this was true both for the Orthodox and Protestant churches. Under the Italians, many foreign missionaries were forced to leave. But later, this turned out to have some good consequences for the Protestant churches in Ethiopia. It forced these young churches to rely on indigenous leadership, and it sparked them into great evangelistic efforts. Well, it was a brutal and difficult time for many Ethiopians. It brought resistance and resolve. The Italians were finally defeated and driven out in 1941 by a combined force of British and Ethiopian troops. Side note, this was one of the first British victories in World War II, which was now in its second year in Europe. Haile Selassie was able to return home and continue his reforms. As I mentioned before, in 1942, he abolished slavery again, this time with lasting effects. He also made an official policy of closed and open areas of the country for missionaries. In closed areas, missionaries were not allowed to do any sort of evangelization. They were allowed to do humanitarian efforts only. This was usually in the places that the Ethiopian Orthodox Church was strong. Haile Selassie did not want any challengers to the native church. However, in open areas, there was no restriction to missionary evangelizing efforts. These open areas were places that the Ethiopian church was weak. Haile Selassie figured if his subjects were not Orthodox, he preferred to have them Christian, whatever the type. And he was happy for the modernizing influence and aid of missionaries to his people. After World War II ended, Italy lost not only its control of Ethiopia, but also its control of Eritrea. You'll remember in the last episode, Eritrea had been colonized by the Italians for the last 60 years. In 1950, the United Nations resolved to join Eritrea and Ethiopia in a federation. But the Eritreans were resentful of this, having been independent, at least from Ethiopia, for a very long time. Because of Eritreans' resistance to his rule, Haile Selassie dissolved the Eritrean parliament and simply annexed Eritrea as part of Ethiopia. This led to a civil war that would last for 30 years until 1991. And even after that, there would be border issues, and a lasting peace wasn't achieved until as recently as June 2018. But there were other problems as well for Haile Selassie. As he aged, his zeal for reform waned. This was unfortunate because it was exactly at the time when Ethiopia needed more reform. Many young people were becoming restless as they saw change and revolution across the world. Wealth in Ethiopia was still isolated among nobility, elites, and the church. Some young Ethiopians derided the government as a feudal system. This was made worse by the economic downturn of the 1970s, along with the devastating famine from 1972 to 74. The Ethiopian government then foolishly tried to cover up that famine, making the effects even worse. All these things combined would come together to bring an end to the Solomonic dynasty, which had been founded some 800 years prior. It also brought an end to royal rule in Ethiopia, which stretched back to a time even before King Izana and St. Frumentius. In 1974, a group known as the Derg, which means the committee, took charge of Ethiopia through a military junta. Haile Selassie and the imperial rule in Ethiopia was over. The revolutionary reign was first met with optimism, as by now Haile Selassie had lost much of his popularity. However, as often is the case with revolutions, soon the Derg was far more repressive than the Solomonic dynasty had ever been. The Derg sought to impose harsh communism on all of Ethiopia. But before we get any further in our story of the Derg, we can now introduce our faithful forebear for today, Gudina Tumsa, known as the Bonhoeffer of Africa. So for Gudina's story, we're going to have to go back a little bit, into the early reign of Haile Selassie, in 1929. He was born in the Weleka region, which is the same region in which Onesimus Nesib from our last episode had worked so hard to bring the gospel. Gudina's family was of the Oromo people and was affected by Onesimus Nesib's mission. Now, both Gudina's mother and father were members of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, though some in his family, specifically one of his uncles, were not Christian at all and practiced magic and animism. But nearby to Gudina's home was a reading school set up by some Lutheran missionaries working in cooperation with Onesimus Nesib. At a young age, Gudina ran away to attend one of these schools. And while at these schools, he heard the gospel. The young Gudina was convinced that the power of Jesus was stronger than any of the spirits that his uncle worshipped, and it led him to cut down one of the sacred trees of his uncle, very much like what St. Boniface from Episode 3 had done in Germany some 1,200 years before Gudina. But this bold challenge to his uncle led to much of his family ostracizing him. But Gudina was not bothered. He'd committed his life to a new path. He continued his education with Lutheran missionary schools into his secondary education. And he picked up English very quickly and soon was an interpreter between English and Oromo. He moved to the city of Nkemte for his higher education, but financial struggles made this process slow. So Gudina worked at a hospital as well. It was here he also met Tishai Tilosa, whom he would marry in 1951. And we'll be returning to Tishai later, hopefully in the next episode. In 1955, he received a scholarship to his studies and pastoral training, and he would be officially ordained in 1958. Already, Gudina was passionate about ideas, and intellectually was a force to be reckoned with. His tenacity as a young pastor got him into a quote-unquote deadlock on the subject of Christian ethics with some members of his church. His superiors decided it was best to move this passionate and somewhat stubborn young pastor to another place for the sake of peace. But his superiors not only saw his passion, but also his potential. So in 1963, they sent him to America to study theology in St. Paul, Minnesota, at Luther Seminary. This was not an easy step for Gudina. His education had not been to a Western standard one. One scholar on Gudina, Ebenezer Urga, says this about his education at this point. Gudina was admitted to Luther Seminary on probation because of his low education standard. He did not even attend high school, but had only elementary education, medical training, and pastoral training. He did not have credentials which enabled him to attend that level of education. However, he was admitted on probation and eventually proved his capability. And prove himself he did. One of his roommates while at seminary would later say this about Gudina. Gudina had shown promise in Ethiopia, and the same was true here. Working in a language which he was not yet completely fluent, lacking a college education that American students had, he did well in his courses, especially during that first year of biblical studies. At 6 feet 6 inches tall, he was not only intelligent and intensely thoughtful, but also exhibited a quick wit and a wonderful sense of humor. His deep piety was combined with a good deal of wisdom about human beings. End quote. While in America, Gudina was also influenced by two American figures. The first was Reinhold Niebuhr, a well-known public theologian who focused on ethics. Gudina also witnessed, and was inspired by, the work of Martin Luther King Jr. Here he saw firsthand faith being put into action through nonviolence. Gudina would follow these events, and he and his African classmates were deeply interested in the struggle of African Americans. Gudina received his Bachelor's of Divinity in 1966. That same year, he returned to Ethiopia. Then his brilliant career as a church leader of his native country truly began. Quickly, he became the Secretary General of the EECMY, the Ethiopian Evangelical Church Makane Yesus. The EECMY is to this day the main Ethiopian Lutheran church body. Gudina had a gift that he could see the differences between Western and African culture and how those differences affected theology. He could also perceive some of the issues that arose from missionary efforts between these two different cultures. For most of his career, he would try to show the global church that the African perspective on the gospel message was an important and a unique one. And he would try to show this perspective could be a corrective to some of the excesses and errors of the Western church. The first error Gudina recognized was the patronizing relationship between European missionaries and donors with their African counterparts. Funding was tightly controlled by foreign donors and missionary agencies. So that even though officially the EECMY was an independent church led by native leaders, they were still under the control of foreign entities through funding with strings attached. Gudina campaigned that this could not be. He said, quote, "At present, what is at the stake in the life of the EEMCY is the identity of a national church. Let it be clear to all that the EECMY is not an agent to carrying out policies and decisions taken in Europe or America. Nor is the EECMY willing to fulfill the purpose of international organizations which appear to be contrary to what she holds to be right." Gudina saw that much of the criteria of this Western funding was focused on Western problems that the Ethiopian church simply did not face. Gudina summarized these problems as imbalances, and he saw the West having two great imbalances in their theology. He called them the old imbalance and the new imbalance. The old imbalance was focused on spiritual salvation while neglecting or downplaying the bodily needs of people. In the old imbalance, service of someone's physical needs was only as a means to an end or as an avenue. The salvation of the soul was the whole purpose, but it had very little to say about the change of society or the well-being of the whole person. But Gudina argued that Jesus did not come just to save the soul. He came to heal the whole person, body and soul. He came to give good news to the poor, to heal the sick, and to free those possessed by demons. Gudina said of this problem, "Has the church been so busy saving souls that the physical and political needs of the man were ignored? Has this not led to an indoctrination of passive subservience as the ideal Christian conduct, which has left colonialism almost unopposed?" End quote. The new imbalance, however, was the opposite problem. It was focused on the physical and political needs of those it was seeking to help, but nothing else. Justice, power, human rights, and economic development were all important, but it gave little or no attention to the spiritual needs of those it helped. The gospel of Jesus Christ granting forgiveness and eternal life was secondary to physical needs, if it was included at all. But this was just as damaging, or worse, than the old imbalance. Gudina was frustrated that Western partners usually fell into one of these two extremes, and would put criteria on their monetary aid based on their own priorities, not on the priorities of the Ethiopian church itself. He saw both of these imbalances as distorting faithful Christianity. In response to this, some other church leaders of non-Western churches had proposed a moratorium on all Western aid for 5 years, so that these churches would develop without being hampered by being directed by Western church entities. But Gudina also rejected this idea. First, he saw how useful the aid was, and a total rejection of all of this would probably cause unnecessary harm. But he also had issues with this strategy theologically. The church, both Western and African, was still one church, the church universal. All churches were therefore interdependent. So without total rejection, Gudina proposed a series of steps to help Ethiopia become less reliant on foreign aid. Gudina said, quote, "We believe that an internal human development, where spiritual and material needs are seen together, is the only right approach to the development question in our society. The division between witness and service, or between proclamation and development, is harmful to the church and will ultimately result in a distorted Christianity. The development of the inner person is a prerequisite for a healthy and lasting development of society." End quote. Gudina brought these ideas to the wider church. He would speak on these ideas in several international church meetings and councils of churches throughout Africa. But the focus of Gudina's efforts would shift as events changed in his home country. and everything changed in 1974, as the Derg took power and the Ethiopian Communist Revolution began. Now, at first, this revolution was welcomed as a necessary change. Remember, Emperor Haile Selassie by this time had lost much of his reforming zeal. Ethiopia was stagnating, and it was looking for new leadership. When the revolution began, it promised to make Ethiopia a country of united peoples, languages, and religions. There would be freedom of religion, human rights, and mutual respect. Many, including Gudina, saw some hope in this. And at the beginning, Gudina expressed optimism, and the EECMY made public statements about cooperation in helping the poor and the support for equal rights for all religious groups. Gudina and the others in the EECMY were happy to work with the new regime, but they were never going to bow to it. And it was quickly seen that the Derg would not tolerate even this kind of independence. For one, the church still boldly opposed atheistic materialism, which the Derg espoused. Gudina spoke on this clearly. Quote, "Man has been created in the image of God, and human beings have freedom, creativity, honor, dignity, deriving from that image. To have a closed understanding of the world and a material understanding of man is to deny essential elements of science and human nature. The truly effective testimony against unbelief is a life by faith. It must be understood that there can be no reconciliation and no compromise between what the church believes and materialism. Marxism, Leninism, and the church can never be friends. Materialism is and lives from below, from matter. But the church lives from the Spirit of God, who comes from above." End quote. During this time, the different Christian groups within Ethiopia began making deeper contacts in the face of likely persecution. Even the Roman Catholic Church and the Ethiopian Orthodox Church were involved in this cooperation. Gudina was elected the first chairman, and in 1975 that body made this statement, a clear response to Marxist ideology. Quote, "The gospel of Jesus Christ is God's power to save everyone who believes in it. It is the power to save from eternal damnation, from economic exploitation, from political oppression, etc. Because of its eternal dimension, the gospel could never be replaced by any of the ideologies invented by men throughout the centuries. It is the only voice telling about a loving Father who gave his Son as a ransom for many. It tells about the forgiveness of sins and the resurrection of the body. It is a dear treasure to never be given up." End quote. But after a few years, this alliance of churches began to fragment under pressure. The Ethiopian Orthodox Church suddenly ended all contact. And by 1978, Gudina was arrested for his activity. At this time, the Derg was led by Haile Mariam Mengistu. Mengistu was a brutal ruler who instigated what is known as the Ethiopian Red Terror. Upper estimates of death he caused are around 750,000. By his ruthlessness, Mengistu was able to get many church leaders in Ethiopia to comply by force, but not Gudina. Gudina was unwilling to bow to these totalitarian ideas of humanity and theology. In 1979, Gudina was arrested by the Derg again. The president of the Lutheran World Federation and other church leaders worked with the government of Tanzania to allow his release and made it possible for his escape from the country. While they managed to free him from prison, Gudina would not accept their invitation to flee from danger. He told them this, quote, "Here is my church and my congregation. How can I, as a church leader, leave my flock at this moment of trial? Christ died for all that those who live should not live for themselves, but for him who died for them and was raised again. Never, ever will I escape." End quote. 1 month later, on July 28, 1979, Gudina was abducted by communist forces and killed by strangulation. His family would not find out his fate for the next 13 years. Because of his bravery, commitment, and unswerving loyalty to Jesus Christ, Gudina Tumsa is sometimes called the Bonhoeffer of Africa. If you do not know him, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a Lutheran pastor who was unafraid to stand up to Nazi Germany and would ultimately be killed for his faithfulness.
Gudina would have made Bonhoeffer proud.
Both took the words of Jesus seriously. Forever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. The legacy of Gudina is still being played out, but his legacy is certainly an incredible one. The Derg fell in 1991, but now the EECMY is the largest single Lutheran church body in the world. Today, its motto is still serving the whole person, and it is greatly inspired by the ideas of Gudina Tumsa. Gudina Tumsa also showed the West the sophistication of African Christian theology and its unique perspective. Gudina knew that Africans had as much to teach their Western counterparts as they had to learn. He was not willing to fall into extremes, but tried to hold difficult and seemingly conflicting ideas in tension. He knew the truth was often found in balance. But his death was truly a great tragedy to Ethiopian Christianity and to world Christianity as a whole. His subtle theological mind and his firm convictions and courage were and are examples for the church of a faithful Christian life. So that is all for our brother Gudina Tumsa. But I do want to speak briefly about his wife as well, Tsai Tolisa, because she endured incredible hardships as well. Her family had been killed during the Italian occupation, and she and Gudina had lost children through natural causes and through violence, and she had supported her husband while he had been in America studying. And she had to endure the hardship of her husband's repeated arrest, and finally his disappearance, in which she wouldn't find out his fate for 13 years. But she too faithfully stood up for her faith, and she would live to see the Derg fall and the Ethiopian Lutheran Church flourish. You can read more about Tsai Tolisa from my friend Simonetta Carr. Simonetta will also be the guest on our next episode, as she'll fill us in on Tsai Tolisa's legacy and sacrifices. If you want to learn more about Gudina, there are several great articles about him on the website The Dictionary of African Christian Biography, which you should check out. There's also a great short book about him simply called The Bonhoeffer of Africa. So I hope you have enjoyed this episode. We will be having one, possibly two more interview episodes in this season on Ethiopia Christianity, which has stretched over 2 years, by the way, and my apologies for that. But I hope you've enjoyed learning about Ethiopian Christianity. My goal in all this is to remind us how big the Christian church is, and always has been. It spans cultures, languages, times, and places, and we have so much to learn from so many brothers and sisters. If you've enjoyed this episode, please let me know. You can contact me through my website or through email or on Facebook. Write a comment or review on whatever podcast app you're using. They're incredibly helpful. And as always, tell a friend.
I'm Eric Claussen, and thanks for listening.